So we'll just get started on this. Now, El Tajin is a site that a lot of people really, there has not been a whole lot written on it. In publications, in scientific journals, not a whole lot was done until the beginning of the beginning of the 1900s. But here's where we are. Here's Veracruz. And you just go up the line a little ways, about like so, and you are at El Tajin. And of course, that's just in the neighborhood of Teotihuacan. So let's take a look a little bit at the time where we are stopped in here. I don't know whether this time chronological table does you any good or not. It always does me a lot of good to look at it. You can see that concurrently with El Tajin, we have Teotihuacan. Can somebody pitch one of those to him?
Yeah.
No, he has that one. He does have
it. Well, the other one's on the bottom picture.
Here. Now your bar down there in Mesoamerica for El Tajin shows it beginning at 550. Actually, there were people living there a long time before that. They're showing you here the years in which it began to flourish, at about 550. And you notice that it extends way up here into the 900s. So what that bar really represents are the years of the peak flourishing of this particular classic culture. And you notice that it was also flourishing when Teotihuacan was, and when there were things going on in Montalban, and also in the Maya world. But now with Teotihuacan declining and destroyed, you see, there was a power that could move into that central part of Mexico, and that power, of course, turned out to be El Tajin. These people, the people who live in that area now, are Totonacan people. And the Totonacan people lived there during the years that this civilization flourished. But it was actually the Huastec people, or sometimes called Huasteca, and that begins with an H. And sometimes you find it with an A on it. And those people were very early comers into this area. In fact, they settled into the area about the same time that the people settled into Teotihuacan. In fact, there are theories that it was the Huastec or Huasteca people that were the first settlers in Teotihuacan. And way back in the time of the Spanish Inquisition, there was a general of the Inquisition whose name was Torquemada. You've probably heard of him, haven't you? Torquemada, well, he was not a really nice man. He lived in the late 1400s, and he was the general of the Inquisition, but he did spend some time on that coastal area where the after Columbus came over. And his theory was that it was the Huasteca who settled Teotihuacan. And when questioned about it, he said, well, he was sure they had settled it because the Huastec people said they had. Mm-hmm. And so there is that possibility that these people who settled in El Tajin also, at about the same time or even earlier, also settled in the Teotihuacan area. For a long time, nothing much was known about El Tajin. It just stood there. And it's in a very tropical area, and the vines grow over things just about as fast as you can chop them away, and they still do. When you walk through on site, it seems almost as though they're going to just gobble up the whole thing, even today. The first person, really, to stumble across this, and it was centuries after the Spanish were there, was a military man. And he was leading a patrol in that area, north of Veracruz, and he stumbled across these large monuments. And he was intrigued by them and started just tearing the things away the best he could with his hands and his patrol helping him. And what he had really stumbled across was the Pyramid of the Niches. How many of you have seen pictures of the Pyramid of the Niches? Well, it's a fantastic thing to see, and he was very awed by it, of course. And he drew pictures of it, and he wrote an article about it, but still, nothing much happened. Nobody paid much attention to it. And then, it wasn't too many years later, probably 50 years later, that Alexander von Humboldt, the great German geographer, had heard about this, and he came over and he looked around and took some sightings on topography and geography, and he wrote it up. Still nobody paid any attention to it very much. Another world traveler came and he made drawings of things that were found there, but he hadn't published in Europe. So it was only in 1938, now that's not very long ago, that the Mexican government decided that they were going to do something about that place, which obviously was the site of a great civilization. And so they set aside this area, which is it's about 2,550 acres they have set aside, that represents the site. And they declared that trees should be cut off from that and brush cleared away. And they got the services of the most eminent archaeologist at the time. His name was Jose Garcia Peon. And they were very lucky in getting that man because that became his life work. He worked at that site and directed all the excavations until his death in 1977.
Mm-hmm. Alpha, was the military man, was he Mexican or was he?
He was Mexican.
He was Mexican.
He was
so
Mexican.
That article was in Spanish then?
Yeah. He was a Mexican on patrol in that area and just happened to stumble across
our basic forces, you know.
Yeah. So many people, so many of those ancient places have been discovered in the same way. Just people stumbling across them. Well, anyway, in the early 1970s, Peon, he must have written something, but there was a young archaeologist from the United States. His name was Wilkerson, Jeffrey Wilkerson. And this man he was interested in this site that they were working on, this particular place. And so he contacted Peon and he came down to help him. Now, Peon was convinced that what he had here in this site and what he had cleared so far, and he had Totonacan workbench, and over that length of time, he made lots of discoveries about what was in the area. It's an interesting site in that it's actually in two places. There's a little creek that comes running around here, and it comes together and meets right around there. And there are really two sections to the site. This place up here is built on a natural terrace. It's natural to some extent that they cut it down, a part of the mountain. But this is a very hilly area. So you have what's called Tajín Chico, meaning Lesser Tajín, and then you have El Tajín Major, which is down here. Well, these two fellas were going to find out what the roots were of this civilization, because they were convinced that in order for the architecture to have developed to the sophistication that it had, and all of the things that they found, they didn't feel they had the things that went far enough back, which would really support the sophistication of the materials that they found. And so they kept searching for the roots. They just knew that they hadn't found the original peoples. And they prowled around their 2,550-acre site, and finally they decided they had to go outside that site a little bit. And so on that map of Veracruz that you have there, find the little city called, well, it isn't a city, it's a village, Santa Luisa. It's over on the right there. It's very close to El Tajín. You find it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the first year, they found some artifacts that dated back to 300 BC. And the second year, they did some more trenching there, and they found some artifacts that dated back much farther. And you'll see that listing on there. They found artifacts that listed back to 4000 BC. Now they have proved that people were living in this area at that time, and that's what they were looking for. Now, I don't know whether you were here when we were talking about the hunters and gatherers, but by 9000 BC, artifacts had been found all over the North American and South American continents, so that we know that people were in the area by 9000 BC. So now they have proved that there were people in this spot 4000 BC. But they still weren't real satisfied because they felt it went back farther than that. So find a little place called La Conchita. It's very close, really, to Santa Luisa, but they tell you about it on the opposite side. Mm-hmm. They started trenching in there, and they found enough to encourage them. And their trench was 20 feet deep. And when they got down to bedrock, they found bones of extinct animals. They found mammals, mastodons, mammoths. They found the horse. They found the glyptodont. They found, and these things dated out 12,000 to 14,000, the end of the Pleistocene era. And they were really excited, but they found no human bones. Now, they were just sure that they were in there someplace. They had found enough things that they were not going to give up. So they started doing lateral trenching. And 3 feet above that 20-foot level, they found a fire pit. And they found tools. So they knew then that this was probably the root settlement of the area. And I believe it tells you here that they dated out 5,600. It should, because that's what they did. And so then they were satisfied. It wasn't very long after that Peón died. But here is my guidebook for El Tajín. And you know, I never really noticed who wrote this thing until I started gathering things together for this teaching project. And this was written by José García Peón, mm-hmm. the man who directed the excavation. So anything you read in here, you see, it's just the way it was. So many times you'll find conflicting dates and conflicting information. But this is the man that over all that time supervised those excavations. Now the young man that came in from the United States continued to work there. He stayed on and continued the investigation. I don't know whether he's still there or not. He was there in 1980 still. But in this article in National Geographic, which if you have it in your home, look back for August 90th, it's all about El Tajín area. If you don't have, your library will have it. It's a fascinating article because it tells about the El Tajín people of today, the Totonacan people who live there now. He felt that it was almost a spiritual place, and this is what he wrote as he closed his article in National Geographic. Day after day I have walked among the massive mounds, the vine-covered forests, the farmers' fields, and Totonac house compounds that now cover the vast site of El Tajín. The sense of sacredness is pervasive in this ancient shrine, with its elaborate architecture and its aura of splendor. One is led to ponder the nature of the mighty rulers who held sway there by faith, hereditary right, and sheer force. Now we know, of course, that these people of El Tajín had a stratified society. They had an elite ruler group, and they had a priest group, and they had artisans, and they had artists, and they had specialists in agriculture, and then they had a peasant workforce to build the things that they built. They had to have a workforce that would do what they asked them to do at the snap of a finger, you see. We also know that their workmen were in other places. If you were here yesterday in Teotihuacan, there was a compound where the people from Veracruz carried out crafts. They were great stone carvers. I think probably, this is a little valley here. We'll look at some of the structures now, and I'll tell you about them as we get to them. I do want to tell you before we start, though, that these people, they were almost obsessed with the ball game. Now, you've probably heard about the ritual ball game that these people, have you? Mm-hmm. Do you know about the ritual ball game? Well, the Olmec played this ball that was played with a hard rubber ball. It's about the size of a softball. And they have different rules in different places. And they're quite sure that in the beginning, it was a game that was played just for fun. But as you moved through the ages, it took on ritual significance. And it was played for keeps at Altahin. Because you'll find on the reliefs of the ball courts evidence through the carvings that oftentimes the losing captain was sacrificed to the gods as a blood sacrifice. There are places in the Maya world where there is a theory that the winning captain was sacrificed. Now that would make me want to lose as far as that goes. That he was sacrificed because it would mean he would go directly into the afterlife. These people believed implicitly in an afterlife. But in this ball game, and the courts are different in different places, some of them have perpendicular sides, and they are different lengths and different widths. And from the carvings that you have and the murals that are painted, you know what they wore. They wore padding around the hips. In some places they wore helmets. They wore gloves. They wore knee pads. And you think of skateboarders when you look at what they wore. But because they were protecting their extremities as much as they could. But the only thing we really know is that they couldn't touch the ball with their hands and that a hip shot was the best shot. And what they were trying to do was to make this ball have some contact with a marker. Now some of the markers are just figures when you visit the ball courts. But some of them, particularly in the Puuc cities up in the Yucatan, have circles with a hole in the middle sticking out from the sides, and they had to put that ball through that hole. So there were different rules, different places, but at Altahin, in the ceremonial courts, this took on the significance of a life and death matter. And so it was played for high stakes. Now you don't get just born a good ball player, so we know they must have played someplace for fun, just like our children play on, you know, in the streets and on their little diamonds in their home territory. But when they got to the place that they were playing as representatives of their particular culture, they were playing for keeps. And there are six ball courts here at Altahin. Only two have been excavated. Some people think they have found more. Some think that there are 10 ball courts here. The Pyramid of the Niches is located right about in this spot right here. And it's relatively small as compared to a lot of the pyramids that you see. Then there's a ball court here, and there's a ball court over here, and this is a big plaza here around here. Not big in size as compared to many of them, because it conforms to the lay of the land. And up here, this area, they think that Tahin Chico was an administrative area. Because it doesn't have the altar pieces. So let's go and look at some of these structures, and we'll start with the Pyramid of the Niches.
Is there significance to the pyramids? Were they a burial ground, or were they superstitious?
In some of them, meaning they were buried there. These men who were doing the excavating did find lots of burials. They found many burials throughout. As you look at these things, I would like for you to look not just at the structure itself, but at the land around it. It's tropical, and it is thick, very thick. The grass is tall, and as you stand at the top of some of these places, you're looking out over seas of mounds. Only 1/10 of the total site that has been set aside has been excavated. Only 1/10.
And apparently it wasn't that way one time, that vegetation didn't exist there, don't you see?
I think they just keep hoeing it back.
Oh.
In the Yucatan today, they can't keep the roads clear unless they go out with a machete and chop them on the side. And some of the homes where the people live back in the bush, they have a big stake tied up along the road, and then they have a piece of plastic on there so that when they ride along their bicycles, they'll know where to turn off. The tropical growth, I think, we don't realize how very verdant it is. This is the little path that leads into the site. There's this little stream is running on either side of this little path. But again, notice the tropical growth, how very thick it is and tall. And this is a very well-kept site, the part that has been excavated, and still there is growth there. And what you see in the background that looks like little humps, those are mounds that have not been excavated. Now you're looking here that the structure just ahead of you is a very important one. It's they give these structures numbers, and this one's number is 5, and that's just so they can keep track of it. But almost all of the pyramidal structures that you see here have been altered or changed, or one built on top of another. The reason this one is so important is that it has on its first platform, which you can't really see from here, a basalt stela, which represents the death head. Notice the central stairway and the very strange type of architecture. You see niches just in one row there. And we're going to turn to the right here, and then we will be inside of the Pyramid of the Niches. Well, here are some women that are going the same way we are. And this structure that you see ahead of you, they think was an administrative place, or perhaps a place where the priests lived, because it doesn't have any of the features that they connected with ceremonial parts, except for the niches themselves.
That is a rock.
There's something wrong here.
What is the rock?
We're in the wrong place, I think. We're in El Tajín Chico. I wonder if I've turned this up too far. And we'll just leave it. And I'll tell you about the building anyway, because I recognize it. This particular building is up on the hill. This is an administrative building, and we're on top of a terrace here. And they think this was strictly administrative. And they haven't reconstructed all of it, just a part of it. And that's quite typical here. They haven't had that much money to spend, and the Mexican government right now wants to do it alone, and they have been of that mind for quite a while. Now, here we are at the Pyramid of the Niches. This is only 60 feet tall. It looks much taller, simply because of the symmetry of the thing. When it was actually used ceremonially, there was a structure on top And from the pieces that they found, they speculate that that topmost piece must have been 20 feet tall. So in all, it would have been an 80-foot structure. It was painted when it was used, covered with stucco and painted. And it was red. And it had blue moldings around the niches. I think we're going to get a little closer to it. Yes, now you can see that there are just niches after niches. In fact, there are 365 niches. And the niches run even behind the stairway. They wouldn't get 365 if they had run behind the stairway. And they represent the number of days in the solar year.
And that soldier was out walking around, that thing was all covered with dirt and foliage?
Yes, and it was in pieces.
Some of it was together, huh?
Yeah, it was not together like this.
Oh.
He found the lower part of it is what he found. And the other pieces were found, and you still find as you walk through the site, you see piles of sculpture down here that they haven't figured out where they go yet. They're probably parts of these buildings that aren't reconstructed. You see, the trees come in and they grow on them. And as we get closer to these, you'll see the vegetation growing on the edges of them. But the thing I'd like you to notice here too is that there are altars going up the stairway. This is a broad stairway coming down. It's interesting on this site because the stairways have real functional use. They don't put them there just for looks. They're there to be used. And up the sides of the balustrades, you have a highly stylized serpent motif going up. Those little frets that go together there. If they can find all the pieces, they would go all the way up, and it's a stylized serpent motif. And the three niches underneath there are not part of the count of the 365. Those are just extra ones that are down there. You could not climb up on this when I was here either time. There's a little sign out front that says no hypothe, and that means you don't go up there. They were worried about the crumbling of the structure. And you don't need to climb up there. There are other places that you can climb up.
Do they think this had a roof cone?
Yes, they think it had a temple. Mm-hmm. They found enough pieces of it that they knew that that's what it was. When these things go down, they go straight down. In Copan, there are, down in the Maya country, there are places where the figures that were on the cornices fell straight down. And they just sat there, you see, and got covered up over the millions of years, hundreds of years. This has flying cornices here, where the cornice sticks out over the panel. And that's unique to this particular place. You find them other places, I guess, so it wouldn't be just unique to this one. But it's very prevalent. As you see the other structures of this site, you'll see the same type of architecture used over and over again.
And what was this, the function of that building?
It was a temple.
Temple.
It was a temple.
You used to go for worship, no one lived there?
No, oh no, this wouldn't be residential. Now, underneath this pyramid, there's another one just like it. Just exactly like it. And I don't know how they know, but they say it has the identical number of niches. They may have tunneled in and then made their speculation on that. But this is an example of superimposition. They put one right on top of the other. So the man who found this, you see, was really bamboozled by it, as any of us would be.
And they have the stairways on the other two sides.
They think that those were used for standards when ceremonies were being held, that they plumped the staff down in there and used them for standards. You can see how the niche is set in there in different levels. And can you just imagine this all colored and then painted in blue and red? It was quite striking to see. They do think that this stairway was used for seating when ceremonies took place out in the middle of the plaza. During the Totonacan phase, they did an aerial ballet called the Valladori Ballet, and we'll see photos of that. Now, if you walk up that path, it goes right up that way, you get up to El Tajín, Chico. Can you see how the lichens and the vegetation works on it? Works on it, and they have to keep taking care of it. You find plants growing over it, and plants can be very destructive to any stonework. These are two interesting buildings. This one is unique. They don't have another one like this in this site. It has a double stairway coming up here to a platform. And then the platform runs along here, and then a single stairway goes up here. But the side structure is different. This is the only one that looks like this on the site. This one over here is completely different again. But these two standing side by side are rather interesting to look at. One is called Building 23 and one 3, which doesn't help us one bit. But they have to number them so they know what we're talking about. Out in front there's a platform. You just see a corner of it there. And that was used for rituals.
Is that carving on the left-hand one to the right of the stairway, or is that simply the way it's eroded? From here it looks like carving.
You mean here?
No, no, the next one over.
But
to
this
the left.
One retains some of the stucco.
To the left. To the left.
Here?
Yeah.
No.
That's
see, these eroded. Were covered with stucco, and you can see here's some of the original stucco on here that has fallen away from the brickwork. And they were all painted. And this one you see a little bit of red on it.
That's the stucco flaking off.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, that's what that is. But there are bits of color on some of these so that you know that at one time this was quite a spectacular place. You walk in and you see this great expanse of stucco buildings in red. They seem to be red and blue. Now again, look at the jungle coming down here, and you can see they've only partially excavated this. You can't get clear around that building. It's still into that mound. This one is completely freed from the mound area. This is 23 again. It's next door to that one. This is all, we're just moving around the ceremonial plaza. This is actually a little different kind of niche. You see it, the way it goes around, and it's kind of, they call it a serpent motif going around there. Now here, standing up on that first platform, is the basalt stela that is the god of death. And he's very black and carved, and he did not originate there. He was moved from someplace else to here because he's much older than the temple. We'll get a little closer to him, but we can't. The light was wrong. Sometimes you're in the wrong place with your light. But his head comes right along here. This is, and it's carved, it has a rather curly design down here. He's quite a formidable looking creature standing up there. And of course, during a ritual ball game, he had particular significance. This is a partially excavated pyramid. They just got the base stairway out of it, and the rest of it is still there. It takes a lot of money to do these things, and they just don't have that kind of money. Now we're going to go up into that jungle area. We just kind of go around a path here. This path, in fact. And on the way you go by what's called the North Ball Court. This runs down about 60 feet, and it is about, 30 feet across. And on the corners there are reliefs. some of the pieces are gone, but enough of them are there that you can make out, and we'll see the ones from the south wall court much more clearly, and you can see the rituals of the ball game, where you have the pulque coat and the, I think there's one in here where it shows the decapitation of the player, the opposing captain. Now here you have the motif of the serpent again. The serpent was important to these people. It represented different things. They thought it might be the patron saint of the arts and literature and learning. And there was also the theory that it was a symbol of immortality, that it meant rebirth. We're on the path. We just went by the wall for it. Somebody else is going to. Now that is just about to my shoulder as I walk through there. This is sugarcane country too. But this is just it's just meadow grass that grows wild. And there are snakes in here, so you whistle and make lots of noise. As you get up the path, you can look back and you sort of get the lay of the site. To the right, you see the pyramid and the niches, and now you can see a little bit more of what's up on the top. And to the left, that structure that has the funny little platform going all around, that's structure 5 that has the basalt god of death on it. And you can see them sticking up there if you know what to look for over to the left. But again, notice the countryside.
You think they use slaves?
Beg your pardon?
You think they use slaves in those days to do all that work?
They used the workforce. You see, they had their stratified society. And they had the ability, they had the power, let's say, to call in enough laborers to do what they wanted to do. And they had artisans. One thing that's really different about this, if you're interested in construction, is that they have large flat roofs on some of these things, and those roofs are made of concrete, some kind of composition that they made from lime that they ground up, shells and whatever, and they built wooden structures. Just like our forms would be, you know, how we set up forms and pour concrete. So they were way ahead of their time. It is one of the few places where they have that, and it's most unusual. For we have to remember that we're a long ways back here. We're 1,000 years ago and more, 1,500 years ago here. This place flourished between the years 600 and 900. That was its peak of existence. But it went way back earlier than that, and it continued after that. But it was a power for 300 years. Now you're still looking back at the Pyramid of the Niches. This is the traveling friend. This is unusual. Motif for them. They call it a lozenge motif. It doesn't look like a lozenge to me. It looks just like the ones that are down on the other building. But this faced one side of an interior court, and they haven't excavated behind it. You still have the earth mound. And if you walk up, there's no place where you can stand on a rock and look out over it. You're just looking out over a sea of mounds that are still standing there. 9/10 of the area still needing to be excavated. This is that building that you saw before, that's the administration building. And after you walk a while, you sit down and rest under that tree, and that happens to be my pack and my stuff. Here we're at the ball court. This is the south ball court. It's a big one. It runs 180 feet long, and it's 60 feet wide. There are no markers there. So you don't know how they kept score. I think we have one. You should be able to see an eagle over here. You see him over here? And there's a seated figure over here. Let's see if we can get a little better in here. Yes, now you can see the eagle. This is the one that is the, where they're doing the drinking of pulque, which is an intoxicating beverage. And they're doing this so that they can have visions. You see the man lying down here? I'll show him to you. I knew I was going to do that. I guess I can carry it with me if I can find it. No, I can't see him. See his feet? Mm-hmm. And here's his head. And here's the priest standing here. And here's an eagle. And this is the pulque ceremony. Also, one of these figures is holding corn, maize. Now, it's amazing that that is as well preserved as it is, when you remember the time that we're talking about. Here you have the serpent. This person is a vision thing. Do you see the head coming out of the serpent? And here you have the seated figure. Very dreamlike, strange sort of configurations there. And they're still trying to figure out what a lot of it means. We're still in prehistory, you know, where we don't have written records.
They probably were painted, so those features also?
I beg your pardon?
Do they think these were painted also then, to distinguish?
There's no paint on them at all. And I know in some places you do find that they were painted, but my guess here is that they weren't. None of the things that I've read say that they were painted, and as usually you can find little flakes of paint someplace if they're painted.
Is that figure, is that a pipe he's got in his hand?
It's some kind of tool. I'm not just sure what that is. But now you see, this is how they were dressed. We have a way of telling the kind of clothing that people wore. And do you see the ceremonial headdress? Probably it was representing feathers coming down there.
Mm-hmm. Like the Egyptian.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we're going to now show you something that's more cheerful than the ball court. And the one that shows the decapitation of the captain does not appear to be in here, of the losing team. The Totonacan people had another ritual, and it was called the Valadores ritual. And in this ritual, there are five people involved. And they dedicate a certain number of their years of their life to this particular dance. And they first climb a 100-foot pole. And up on the top of this pole, there is a wooden sort of structure that has ropes running around it. And it turns on the top of this pole. And in the middle of this rectangular or square structure, there is a small platform. Now these men are going to climb this pole. One of them is going to get on this little platform, which doesn't appear to be from way down below, much bigger than this. And he carries a drum up as he goes. And he's the drummer. The others climb out on that frame and attach themselves to a rope that is in one of their corners. And then they throw themselves backward over this frame. And as they throw themselves backward, it begins the movement of this rectangular frame. And it turns around, and they fall down backwards, head first, in a kind of aerial ballet. And they're called the Valadores. Now, first we're going to go to the museum and see some of the ceremonial gear worn by the ball players. These are stone. Now, they didn't wear these when they played ball. They couldn't have, because they're too heavy. But they wore them before the ball game and after the ball game. The Veracruz people were well known for their stonework, their carving of stone.
Where did they wear that? Around their neck?
Around their body.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Around the part of their body. Well, this needs to be turned a little bit there in order to be focused. Mm-hmm. But I think I might have one that would. I'm going to do that because this is.
I'll do it.
There's focus.
It just needs a little bit more focus on it there. This is called a palma, and they wore this also. Not going to do any better? Well, let's try another one. There. They wore this on their belt too, and I can't imagine even wearing this for a ceremony. This is in front of a mirror so you can see the back of it. And it had obsidian eyes. And they wore this as part of their regalia when they paraded around the ball court before the game began and after the game was over. And these carved pieces were trade goods too. People from Mesoamerica traded for the carving that was done at Veracruz. These were figurines that were part of their pottery work. And they had, this is a Totonacan one, head. It's a beautiful piece. It's about so big. But they were masters of all kinds of crafts, really. Mm-hmm. Now I think we're going to go with the Valladolid. This is their poem. You want to see if you can sharpen that focus?
Yeah.
A little bit.
Yeah.
And they have climbed up and they're just little sort of, they look like just little things sticking out about that far that they climb up. When this ritual was being done during the times that this was a flourishing civilization, that pole was made from wood. And it was a ceremony to go out into the woods and find the tree and thank the gods for the tree and ask the gods' permission to take the tree, much like the American Indian believe in the spiritual life of what we consider inanimate things. But now they use a metal pole. Also during the time that this was being used, during the time that the civilization flourished, these people went into a retreat where they lived a life of abstinence for a number of weeks before they did the performance. Now they're hooking themselves on, and this central man is standing on that little bitty platform that's there. Here you can see that what they climbed up. Mm-hmm. Now they have thrown themselves off backwards over this frame. And as it's the momentum that carries it, and this frame moves around, and they move with it.
They've occasionally even brought this back to San Antonio for special things.
Do they?
Yes.
This is this particular aerial ballet was also practiced in other Gulf Coast sites at this particular time. Now, this young man is probably about my size. He's about my height and about my build. And I would guess in his late teens. It's amazing to me that the hat stays on.
Yes, it is.
fly backward there. Okay, I think that that is all that we have here. Yes. Could we have the lights again? Oh, it didn't tell you what happened to him in the end. Well, beginning at about the year 900, there began to be a decline in the community in the city, in their power. It seemed to be waning. And by 1250, the city had been abandoned and burned. There's nobody there anymore, and then that's when the jungle came in. Now, they have a pretty good idea of who did this. They think maybe there was an uprising and the Totonacan people rose up against the Huasteca people that were there. So it could have been internal insurrection. It could have been unhappiness because of forced labor. It could have been unhappiness because of the ruling group, whatever it was. Then there was also a theory that the barbaric tribes from the north came down, the Chichimecas came down and wiped them out. But whatever it was, people continued to live there for a long while after the decline of the civilization in the 900s. They continued to live there into the 1200s. But by 1250, everybody had gone. The place had been burned. And when you think about it, this has happened each time. You see, the same thing happened to the old men, the same thing happened to the people of Teotihuacan, conscious kind of a cycle. You have the rise of the civilization, its flourishing, its decline, and then its eventual destruction. Makes you wonder what's ahead of us. Because, and you think about, you have the Romans and the Greeks and all the people of history. There seems to be just a pattern of people rise to power. Think what's going on in Europe right now. Mm-hmm. We have the rise in power of the Soviet Union. Is it in a decline now, would you say? And are we having insurrection and everything going on? The same thing, if you think back a few years to Great Britain, remember how her colonies reached out all over into Africa, and so did those of France. And so you have the rise of power of the British, and now the British are just... Not only that, I sometimes wonder what they're going to find in our garbage dumps when they do. Can you think of anything that you would like to ask me that I might be able to answer?
Was this a wealthy... I mean, do you think they were attacked because of their wealth, or weren't they particularly?
There was always tribute paid. Mm. There was, you see, you have to feed all these people, and there was tribute brought in. Their economy was based on agriculture and trade. Their agriculture, this is the area of the production of vanilla, cacao, coffee. So this is a very fertile area for agriculture. Plenty of rain, you know, rich soil, you could tell from the growth there. And they had artisans, they had time to develop an artisan group. And their trade extended. Classic Veracruz pieces, and one of the strange pieces is mirrors. They would trade for ore, just like the people of Teotihuacan. And they didn't use the ore for anything that we would use the ore for. They made mirrors out of it. And they backed those mirrors with carved stone. And they were very much in demand in trade. So you had these people moving into the sphere of influence of Teotihuacan, which had risen and fallen. And they had trade routes going all over the place. So you don't know whether it was disruption of trade, whether it was had agricultural implications, or whether it was unhappiness with the ruling class. Well, it could have been all of them. Mm-hmm. Now, like in Russia, what was it? What had caused the disturbance in Russia? They're hungry, right?
economic factors mentioned, as well as whatever kind of government is controlling. Well, I hope you enjoyed knowing more about the classic Veracruz. It's a subject that's not the El Tajín site is doesn't get the credit it deserves.
Is El Tajín now an oil field?
There is oil down up above that. No, El Tajín. You don't. You're close to an oil field.
Close.
I don't know whether on that little map I gave you, you find Costa Rica.
Yeah, it shows that, I think.
Well, that's just reading the oil. Yeah. Yeah. So that's definitely an oil area there. Mm-hmm. But so far, El Tajín is just clean. They have set that acreage aside, that 2,550 acres, and boy, nobody gets in there. You can tell as you walk through there that there are people on the move there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're not going to walk away with any of those little pieces of sculpture.
that date of 5,600 BC, is that carbon dating or something
you
like that?
You betcha. It's carbon dating.
That's pretty accurate.
Yes, it's very accurate. Well, within, they think within 200 years.
It is, huh?
Yeah.
I can see all those things 500 million years ago, and I can't believe anybody's got a machine that...
You can't do carbon 500 million. You can't do radiocarbon 500 million. You have
well,
to
whatever
do
whatever you do.
Yeah. Now, radiocarbon...
I got to believe them, though. That's 500 million years
ago. Yeah, you do.
And I wonder. I'm skeptic, I guess.
But radiocarbon doesn't work on that, because it doesn't go back that far.
But you can imagine their excitement when they got to the place where they found these bones of extinct animals, and they dated out 12,000 to 14,000 BC.